Hey, welcome to the Life 2.0 Podcast Veterans Day episode. I'm John St. Augustine. Glad to have you joining me from wherever you are. Time to go up the down staircase in the outdoor, make sense out of the senseless, and find the obvious buried in the frickin' absurd. Let's get to it. Thanks once again for joining me on the Life 2.0 podcast. This is the Veterans Day edition of this show. And as a proud veteran of the United States Coast Guard, I get a chance to talk a little bit and boast a little bit and brag a little bit about our branch of the service and give my thanks to all the brothers and sisters that I have that have worn the military uniforms over the years, Army, Air Force, Navy, Marines. And it's an interesting thing. In full disclosure, this is the second run through of this show. I actually did the first one yesterday, and in a minute I'll tell you why I had to redo this, but it's always interesting to me when I have to go back and actually redo a whole show. There's edits in here, no doubt. You know, it's between 5 and 7 o'clock in the morning, which is kind of prime time for me for the most part. But I had to do some digging on a statistic that I included that is far more research than I wanted to do. And even though I've learned a lot about this particular statistic, it's still a little bit unnerving and challenging to even grasp my mind around it and talk about it. And before we get on to the celebrations of Veterans Day and how it all started, which is, you know, all well and good, should have learned that back in sixth grade, but you have to still these days, even though there's more information at our fingertips than any other human has ever had, sometimes this podcast to me feels like a little bit of a class in trying to figure things out and making sure we know what we're doing and maybe, you know, get a little bit more clarity. I'll get to that in a little bit. But a statistic has been bouncing around for quite a while that says 22 veterans a day commit suicide. And it's a powerful, powerful movement around that. Not too long ago, I saw a young guy who was a U.S. Army veteran who was walking, you know, 22 days in a row and 22 miles on those 22 days to bring awareness to the 22 suicides that take place. A few years ago, if you remember, if you do any online stuff, there was all this movement around like the ALS ice bucket challenge where people would dump ice buckets of water on their head and raise money. And then came along the 22 push-ups for the 22 suicides per day. And while I guess, you know, for a lot of people, that's all they can do around that. And, you know, when it comes to suicide, stuff we don't often talk about, maybe that is all we can do. You know, I've had three people that I know of, two pretty close, that took their own lives years ago. And I've talked three or four, maybe five, not out of it, but gave them options they may not have been seeing when it came to that. And they're still here. I think it always comes down to perspective and things like that. And one of the most difficult things about suicide is I sit here kind of wringing my hands together, honestly, remembering these conversations, was that it's, you know, as a human being, no matter what you've gone through, it's important, I think, to gain perspective and leverage all the time. Because when you see things differently, then things, you know, your life has a different tone and tenor to it. But if you get a myopic view on certain things, it can definitely drive you into the ground. And to make permanent decisions on what I consider temporary problems, you know, that's where it comes down to it. Some people think that their problems are permanent. This life's never going to change. And what's the point of being here? And when you listen to that voice enough, you'd probably be right. But the world's a big place and you never know what tomorrow's going to bring. And all those type of things. So having conversations with people who are literally on the edge of their lives has been something I don't talk about much. I've done it. I'm never comfortable with it. But I also know that I felt I was in that place at the right time, hopefully to say a few right words in the right way that may help. Those who decided to follow through with taking their lives, I don't judge it in any way, shape, or form, except choices create a ripple effect and the pain that they felt that was so insurmountable that they decided to take their life was simply passed on to the people who were left behind and bewildered and sad and broke. So there's no while pain ends for the one person, it is simply compound interest of the worst kind for those who are left behind. So anyway, in all of that, this statistic of 22 veterans a day has been bouncing around for years. And I came across some information about the 22 veterans thing, and that it was inaccurate to a great degree. And then the inaccuracies came from a report that was done like 2011 by the VA, but it left out most of the states in the union. Out of 50 states, it only counted these deaths and suicides and things out of 22 states. It was a very small number, and that report gained a lot of traction. And what came out of that was, you know, when things get out of the bag, when it bursts open, it's kind of hard to put it back in the bag, and it's all about the context. So I came across five or six sites that said this. The statistic comes from the VA's 2011 suicide data report, which analyzed death certificates, I'm sorry, from 21 states, not 22, I stand corrected, from 1999 to 2011. Not very broad space of time. The report calculated a percentage of suicides identified with veterans out of all suicides and death certificates from those 22 states during the project period, which turned out to be 22%. By a point of reference, about 13% of U.S. adults are veterans, according to a 2012 Gallup poll. Then the report applied that percentage against the number of suicides in the U.S. during a given year, which is an astonishingly high amount, in my opinion, of 38,000 people every year take their lives. Divided by the number of days in a year, the report came up with 22 veterans take their lives every day. Now, in the report, they also mentioned and cautioned against the use of the 22 death figure more than one time. I mean, they went back and said at least three times, it is recommended that the estimated number of veterans be interpreted with great caution due to the use of data from sample states and existing evidence of uncertainty in veterans identifiers on U.S. Death certificates. So they really came down to a range of 18 to 22, which is consistent with other VA estimates from the CDC. The report, as I mentioned, did include all the states, some of which have the largest veteran populations, including California, Texas, Georgia, Arizona, and North Carolina. So there's no way to know what that would have done to the bottom line of these numbers. So while the figure is, you know, we hear this 22 veterans thing every day, and it becomes background noise to some greater or lesser degree, and it gets associated oftentimes with Iraq and Afghanistan. And it, for sure that it does, but that seemed, you know, that was where you would think this would mostly take place. But the truth is, the average of male veteran suicide in this report was 60 years old. So it's way too old for those who would be serving in Iran and Afghanistan, for the most part. And so it's like, that's like on the early end of Vietnam. I mean, I'm 62. So if you go back to 2011 when this was going on, it may line up for the Vietnam years, I would guess. So my point in all this is I did this yesterday, and I dug into all this, and I thought, well, this is good news, because at the end of the day, when it really came down, when the dust settled, there was at least a half a dozen resources that I found that said it really comes down to about one or two veterans a day, which is already too many. But in the context of 38,000 plus, it's minuscule in amount compared to what they had said before. And I had put this thing together, and it had a couple of audio problems too. It didn't sound exactly like I wanted it to, but it came out that, you know, maybe that was not accurate. This 22 veterans a day suicide thing, that the context wasn't there. And what happens? We get a number and we run with it. And yes, it's important. And yes, you know, we try to do something to look at that. But the truth is that this morning, as I was getting ready to redo this, basically, all those sources that I cited and found, they're at least 5 years old. It was very, very difficult for me to find anything that came, you know, closer than 2014, 2015, based on that 2011 report. And I guess because it takes so long, you know, research-wise, to get a lay of the land, a blueprint of really what's going on when it comes to this type of stuff, that there wasn't anything more recent, except for one. I then found a report in 2016, which is about 5 years newer than the one in 2011, and that an average of 20 veterans, now we're down two already, died by suicide each day. Six of the 20 were recent users of VA Health Administration services back as late as 2013, 2014. So again, really hard to get a grip on this thing. And they go through this whole narrative, which I'm glad I'm not in research because I'd go nuts with this shit. You know, veterans between 18 and 39 and between 50 and 69 and 80 and older have seen increases in suicide rates. And one of the other factors that was never included because it's veterans was that somehow active duty personnel were being lumped into this narrative, this research piece. So here's the thing. I was really hoping, because this is what I came away with yesterday, I felt better about the fact that maybe it wasn't 22 vets a day taking their lives. You know, maybe that number was far less than I thought, that has been bantered about for years, that people are doing push-ups for or walking, you know, 22 miles, 22 days for to raise awareness. But it really comes down to it, one's more than too many. And I have no control over that, nor do you, for the most part. But what I wanted to call attention to the fact was that these men and women who served, you know, whatever their reasonings are, and I could find no evidence that says here's exactly why they're taking their lives. It may have been military related, it may not. So the image of 22 veterans coming out of Iraq and Afghanistan taking their lives is not true. That's not true. But what is true is there are still at least between 18 and 20 that do take their lives, but they're mostly older. And again, there's no real knowing of how this falls in with the military background that they have. So the great challenge on Veterans Day for me is this, is I don't believe suicide's preventable in the fact that if somebody's going to do what they're going to do, then that's what they're going to do. As I mentioned, I talked with a few people who made a different choice by the time we were done talking and did other things and found therapies, and they're still here. And there are people that I had conversations with that aren't here. So I don't know how that all works. And I don't do as much of that as I used to. I've really pulled back from all of that, unless it's like sitting here right in front of me. But the fact of the matter is that this concept that somehow veterans need more help is true. But I don't think they need more help from the Veterans Administration. I think they need more help from you and me. And being a veteran myself, I'm saying this as plain as I can. More times than not, I see things pop up on social media where we're demanding better X, Y, and Z for our veterans, better health care, you know, anything that fills in the blank for our veterans, that there are veterans issues that must be addressed and must be taken care of. And it kind of comes in waves. It has been a while since there were headlines about poor care at the VA and what have you. And for the record, I use very few veterans resources that are available to me. I go in every 6 months for a checkup. I got a couple of suspected skin things burned off last summer. About 5 years ago, they fixed my deviated septum and I didn't see a bill. And, you know, it was very few. And I try to maintain myself as best I can to stay out of the system, which helps it move along. I've never had a bad day there. But there are people that do. And whenever I go into the VA here in Chicago, it is a bag of mixed emotions. I see people who we walk in and we walk out and you kind of nod and you know, give each other a bit of a half salute. And, you know, everybody's kind of in the same boat there, no pun intended, especially if you're in the Navy or the Coast Guard. The people who serve us, the doctors and the nurses and the research people and the staff, outstanding. I mean, every day. Every single day. Whenever I call for something, it's all done. So my experience is top-notch with them. And the headlines always, as just like this 22 veterans a day thing, don't always show the full breadth and width and scope of all this. So here's my suggestion to make Veterans Day even better, which is like every day, right? If you know someone who served, it kind of gets pushed in the background after time. But the best way to support veterans is to physically, mentally, spiritually, and emotionally go support a veteran. If veterans' issues bother you and you're one of these people who jump online and say, we must change the system, well, here's the best way to change it. Go spend time with a vet. They'd be more than happy to have you come and volunteer at a VA hospital and talk to the men and women who, so many of them forgotten and so many of them, you know, having a difficult time. And I think about this one program I signed up for. I still never heard back. It's probably all red tape, and it, my time may have come and gone with that. But there's a program they have where you can sit with those who are in the final stages of their lives that are being cared for at the VA, and all they want you to do is sit with them. You're not here to fix anything. You're not here to change anything. You're just there to sit with them and listen if they want to talk, but that they're not alone. And I think that, to me, is like something should have a rally cry more than the 22 veterans, or 18 to 20, I should say, veterans who take their lives. That if we could imagine the difference, that if you take an hour a month or 2 hours a month and go sit with a veteran who needs to be heard, the difference that makes in their lives is incalculable, in my opinion, especially in the final time of their lives. So on the Veterans Day, you know, it's important to go out and get the free meal. You know, television is inundated with all these friggin' sales and stuff like that. I don't participate in it. I just find that stuff just, it's like the opposite of what the day is all about. And speaking of that, one of the big challenges, any veteran will tell you this, I would think, is that if you really want to muddy the waters, don't thank veterans for their service on Memorial Day. Please don't do that. They are separate dates. You see this all the time, and I guess maybe it's an ongoing educational piece that needs to be constantly reinforced. Veterans Day is totally distinct from Memorial Day because that's in May, number one. Veterans Day celebrates the service of all U.S. military veterans, while Memorial Day honors those who had died while in military service. So when you see Memorial Day in May and you get that day off, don't go around thanking veterans. What you should be doing is taking a few minutes to remember those who didn't come home from all the wars. And that's why you have a day off. You have Armed Forces Day that also takes place in May. Those are for the men and women who are currently serving. So I know it's a little confusing, three moving parts here. Memorial Day for those who didn't come home. Veterans Day for guys like me who served and are still sticking around. Armed Forces Day honors those who are serving currently. It's almost like a shell game, kids, but you got to know which coconut you're looking at. So please, as you move forward in all of this, Veterans Day is the day you thank veterans. Memorial Day are the day you put your thoughts and prayers and thanks for those who didn't come home. And Armed Forces Day, go out and slap somebody wearing the khaki. That's what it's really all about. You know, in the last couple of minutes here, I'm really working to keep these things a little bit shorter. The last one I did was almost an hour, but you know, there's a sweet spot here, and that's between, you know, like 20 and 40 minutes. And I got to tell you, just real quick, my memories of serving, they've never left me. And I don't think you can ask any veteran, whether that was war or peacetime, they'll come up with stories about all that went on. And I think about how my life changed when I entered the military service. It was 1979, the Iranian hostage thing was going on in Iran. And I was in college. I'd already played 2 years of football, and I got electrocuted, and it was a long, you know, you can read about it in the books. I couldn't write, so I took a year off, and I'm working. And this whole thing's going on television, and I think I'm gonna go join the Marines, and I'm gonna, you know, be one of these guys that gets these people out. And I don't know, like midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning, not too long after I had that thought, I got a phone call from a guy named Mike Cleary. And Mike, if you're out there anywhere, call me, find me. Mike Cleary was a guy we called the Senator. I don't know why we called him the Senator at college. He maybe looked like a senator. I can't recall. But he worked in the swimming pool. He was a lifeguard. And my girlfriend at the time was a lifeguard in the pool. So I knew this kid. And then one day he was just kind of gone. Never heard from him again. How he got my phone number, I will never know. I never asked him after that. But I get a phone call at midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning. And it's this guy, Mike Cleary. And he is obviously had a few, and he's calling me from Kodiak, Alaska. And he's going on about got the best job in the world, and he's out hunting and fishing, and he's on this ship. And I'm like, wait, what, would you join the Navy? He goes, hell no, man, I joined the Coast Guard, brother. And I'm like, really? So we talked about that for a few minutes. I'm like, well, good for him. You know, he's a lifeguard guy. He likes the pool, that kind of stuff. Now, I could swim like a fish, but never gave much thought to anything like the Coast Guard. My cousin Rich, the Sarge, was in the Marines. I thought that's kind of the direction I want to go. And so within the next day or two after that phone call, I went to a recruiting office. And at that time, this was in Niles, Illinois, and it was one of those where all the services were represented. You know, everybody was there. The Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, Coast Guard were all in one building. And I walked in to talk to the Marine recruiter. You got to remember back then, and I do, this was now either late 1979 or early 1980. I was 20 years old, 21, let's see. Yeah, 22 years old. And, you know, high and tight and in really good shape and all the stuff that goes along with that, I look like a prototypical Marine would look. And I walk into the recruiting office, and it's right around lunchtime, and all the doors were closed. Marine closed, Army closed, Navy closed, Air Force closed. All the doors were closed. There was only one door open at the end of the hallway, and it was Coast Guard recruiting. And I thought, that's Coast Guard. It's where Mike Cleary's at. And I walked down there just, for, you know, like, close, close, close. I kept walking, and I get down there, and I stand in the doorway. And I couldn't tell you who the recruiter was. And he says, can I help you? I said, yeah. I was looking for the Marines. He goes, well, they're at the lunch. Come here. Let me talk to you for a second. I signed up. That day, I felt like it was, you know, must have been some sort of sign that Mike called me and I knew this guy. And as soon as I mentioned Kodiak, Alaska to this guy, he's like, oh, yeah, we can get you to Alaska. No problem. He ain't kidding. So I signed up and I felt like I actually started to turn in a direction in my life that was important. I was, you know, ready to do something. And I remember that my departure to boot camp was delayed two or three times for reasons I don't recall. So I had like three going away parties and they were freaking fantastic. And finally I was on a plane to Alameda, California, which was a little bit odd because back then there was two Coast Guard boot camps, Cape May, New Jersey and Alameda, California. And usually being that far east in Chicago, I'd have gone to Cape May, or as we call it, Skate May, because it was a lot easier than Alameda. Alameda was run by, you know, a bunch of drill sergeants that were, you know, Marine guys or whatever the deal was. That was the rumor. Alameda's a lot tougher. Well, send me there. I want to go there. So I got shipped off to Alameda, California. And those 9 weeks in boot camp were just unforgettable to me. I was in really good shape physically, so that was not much of a challenge. The mental stuff was about half and half, only because when you play football for, you know, high school, college football, and you get yelled at most of the time. Getting yelled at was nothing new. But it was the rigors of it were, it's there to break you down so it can build you up. And I think of those, I've never seen one of the guys that I was in boot camp with, even when I was in the service for those 4 years, plus two in reserve, never ran across any of them again. The thing I remember most is we called each other by where we were from. We had a guy we called Mississippi, we called Texas, they called me Chicago. And that's how you kind of connected with guys. So 9 weeks later, I come out of boot camp, you know, high and tight and ready to go on and take on the world. And interestingly enough, I had my choice of where I wanted to start my career. And they had this whole list. And I finished number one. I was actually tied with a guy from wherever. And he had me on points for the academic side. And I had him on points with the physical side, which tells you a whole lot about me. And I had number one pick. I think I beat him by 2 points or something. I don't recall. And there was an opening at Coast Guard Air Station Chicago. And I thought, I could go on helicopters? Now that's got moment for me. Not that I wouldn't go on board ship if I had to, but I thought, well. And I remember looking at this guy, and he wanted sea gas bad. He wanted Air Station Chicago bad. And I think he lived in one of the suburbs of Chicago. I can't recall. But I just kind of like, you know what, screw you, I'm taking it. So I did. It was such a great move on my part. And came home maybe a week later, I guess, not 2 weeks for sure, but probably had a week off to say hi to everybody. And I remember walking in to see my folks, you know, in my dress blues, and how that felt, just really something. Get to Chicago, Coast Guard Air Station, Chicago. I get to Coast Guard Air Station, Chicago, and, you know, it's just a learning process. I pull up the NAS Glenview main gate, and unless you have a clearance pass for your vehicle and registered, you can't drive it on. So I had to wait. I had to park up front, and I got my C bag full of all my stuff and wearing my dress blues to show up for my first day on duty. And I walked, I don't know, it was a mile and a half, whatever it was. And I had to be there by, I think, like noon or something. But not me. I'm going to be there at 7 a.m., 6, 7 o'clock in the morning. So I got there early. I tramp all the way down to the air station, and it's the farther end of the air base. And I'm walking past all these, you know, Marine Corps planes and Army helicopters. And I'm thinking, this is just the coolest thing. And as I walk all the way back, I get to this enormous hangar, Coast Guard Air Station, Chicago. And I bang on the door, bang on the door, bang on the door. Nobody comes, nobody comes. So I ring a bell. And finally, this guy shows up at the door, opens it up, and he says, "What do you want, meat?" And it was Dan Manning, who I'm still in touch with today. And Danny was the yeoman at Coast Guard Air Station, Chicago. He's from the South. You know, I don't know if he's from Southern Illinois originally. I can't remember. He's got this great drawl. And he's actually a couple years, was it a year ago I did the anniversary show podcast? He's on there. Got a great, great voice, great guy. And a great coastie. And I mean, reporting for duty, sir. And he's like, "Don't call me sir. I know who my parents are," you know. So it was such an indoctrination for me at the age of 22 to be part of that. And I grew up quick. I learned the concept, and which I already kind of had from football, those years of football. I learned the concept of we over me. We could sure use more of that reminder in our world today. For certain, the crew at Seagas Chicago came from many different parts of the country with all different beliefs and a myriad of backgrounds, right? And there was always spirited conversations about what was and what wasn't, and politics and whatever, sports. And it was a healthy mix of opinions and observations and things like that. But here's what I recall and remember the most. When the SAR bell rang, the search and rescue bell went off, when there was a mission to be undertaken and accomplished, all that bullshit went to the side. There was no division. Every single guy and woman knew their job. We've been trained for it. And so the pilots ran to the helicopter and the air crew got the thing ready. It was already, you know, fueled up. I'd often run up to the radio to get on the comms watch, and all the pieces fell together. And lives were on the line every single time. Not just the people who may need our help, but our lives, the safety end of things, and depending on each other. And that's the thing that I think I recall the most. I mean, the stories are, I could do a whole podcast on the shit that happened there. The statute of limitations has run out, so I think I could get away with it. But that concept of putting all your personal stuff aside, whether you agreed or disagreed with a guy, didn't matter. What mattered is you had a job to do. And I think about how things have been here in this country for the last, you know, however many years, and that it's more about me than we. It's about, what about me? What about my feelings? What about my needs? Anybody who's in the military at some point has been told what to do and didn't like it. May not have even agreed with it, but you trusted the process of it, even if you could see the flaws in it, until it became apparent that something else had to be done. And we just went through this whole thing with Cyrus the virus, and there's been so much about me. What about me? What about me? What about me? What about me? It's not me the people, it's we the people. It's a big difference. So my 4 years in set me up, I think, for the rest of my life. My reenlistment talk or pitch was given to be my Carol Dickman, Chief Carol Dickman, and he came up to me and said, "Listen, unless you're going to stay in for 30 years, get the hell out. You're too talented, you're too young, you're this, you're this, you're this." And my friend, the late, great Lieutenant Rusty Muncy, who just passed about a month ago, was pushing me to become a pilot, go to officer's candidate school. And I really thought about it hard. Oddly enough, when I was in high school, I had a full ride scholarship offer, which is kind of negligible, meaning it's a military branch, but from the Coast Guard Academy to come play football. I thought, what the hell would I do there? I end up being an enlisted guy there instead of the Coast Guard Academy and becoming an officer right away. But this is how my life has gone, and I'm good with it. I just have such stellar and wonderful memories of the people I served with there. A special shout out to my buddy, Chief Gary Butler, who is a subscriber of this podcast. He's one of the guys I've stayed in touch with the most since those early days at Coast Guard Air Station Chicago. So many other names, you know, pop into my head. Steve Zimek and Rusty Muncy, as I mentioned, and Lieutenant Angert and Kali, Brenda Woodfalk and Danny Manning and Johnny Metza. And as the years have gone by, some of these people I've stayed in touch with. Mike Hicks and I had lunch last summer. Hicksie really is, you know, one of the all-time greats. He's got, you know, Coast Guard life-saving awards that very few people get. And Lieutenant Snyder, who passed away last year, was the first guy, when I got in a helicopter, did what's called an auto rotation, you know, to make sure that your lunch and your dinner don't stay down. We went up and we were over somewhere out over the lake, and it's the kind of thing where you basically, in the old days, you know, if you had a car with a clutch in it and it died, you could push it or run it downhill and pop the clutch and hopefully start the engine again. Auto rotation's kind of like that. Let's go up and turn off the engines and see if we can safely auto rotate down and hopefully everything works out. Thanks for that, Lieutenant Snyder. Rod Leland and Cal Lee, Chief Dickman, as I said. So many of these people, Jeff Strolberg and Mike Phillips and Bob Lyons, and the list goes on and on. Captain Jerombeck, who was also on that that podcast I did last year for the Coast Guard's birthday, as we call it. I've stayed in touch with him as well, and he's just another guy who, you know, is in this blueprint in the back of my head that was an influence on me. So, closing this up for this Veterans Day, I feel like I've rambled way too much. I don't know if there's a coherent sentence in this whole pile of stuff here, but I am proud to have served this country, and I look at it as almost like a parent, meaning, you know, you love your parent and you wish they'd work on some of their flaws to be better, like we all should. And I see our country this way. We're still very, very young, and we're still trying to figure our shit out, and it gets old and it gets over the top most of the times, if not all the time. And I keep realizing that whether it's me just spending a little bit of time with a vet for an hour once a month, or doing this podcast about veterans and trying to clear up this thing about veteran suicide, you know, any more than one is too many, or just simply sharing memories of my time in, there's a pattern there for me. And it still, to me, feels like I'm serving on some level. This is just a different branch. You know, I've taken everything I've learned in the military, so many lessons. Tim Watson comes to mind. Geez, I almost forgot Doc Watson. You know, Roger Schenck. We're in the process of actually trying to, Roger and I and a few other guys, we came across one of our helicopters, 1459, sitting outside the NAS Glenview grounds, which is now where people with million-dollar homes live. There's very few pieces of that air station even left anymore. The runways and the golf course, they're all people's homes. But 1459 was donated to the Museum of Science and Industry quite a few years ago. And somehow this little upstart Glenview Museum got it. And one thing led to another and then fell apart. And they were supposed to have it on prominent display, and it didn't happen. And now it's sitting in a parking lot outside of the former base boundary. And Mike Phillips, actually, who I mentioned earlier, put up some pictures of the 1459 sitting there. And since I was the closest, I drove up, and it's kind of creepy, actually, to see this thing sitting there, this hull of this great airship sitting there, kind of going to shit. And so I took a bunch of pictures, and we made a little bit of a rally, and I got a hold of the guy who and his team that run the Glenview Air Base, and I got a hold of Raj, and Raj and Jim Smith and I met this past March there, and we basically sealed the helicopter for the summer because there's all kind of shit going on in there. Took a bunch of pictures. And we're in the process of attempting to get that over to Grand Haven, Michigan, which is Coast Guard City, USA, to get that thing restored and put back where it could be, as opposed to it just, you know, dying a low, slow death out in the parking lot. As well intentioned as that might have been, been in touch with them to get that done. So that's like one last piece of my time there, and preserving that is important to me. And I think it's important to the guys that flew in it. And the response has already been, I'll take vacation days and come help. So there's an attachment to that time in my life that is very, very profound for me. Here in my studio, if you ever came by, you'd see my boot camp pictures. Then you see this kind of a collage that somebody made for me with my time in. And then there's the picture on the other side of the crew at Coast Guard Air Station Chicago in 1983, standing in front of 1446, which was our other helo. And I got a couple little helicopter things here and my flight helmet and stuff, and just pieces of my history from being a veteran. And when I look back at it on 30 plus years, no, Christ, it's 40 years now, nothing but pride there. And, you know, in its final analysis, every veteran, whether you're in the Marines, the Coast Guard, the Navy, the Air Force, the Army, you sign a piece of paper saying that you're willing to die for your country. If it comes to that, you will lay your life down. Not a lot of people do that. Most don't. And so on this Veterans Day, I salute those who were willing to sign that piece of paper many times over. Many times over. I did it once, and then I did 2 years in reserve. And those memories have stayed with me to this day. So on Veterans Day, as we get ready to wrap this one up, I was thinking about when I was in about sixth or seventh grade and took music class with Mrs. DePago. She scared the shit out of me. Jesus. Great lady, I'm sure, but oh my gosh. I see her at the end of the hallway. I didn't want to, no thanks. But she was a music teacher, and eventually we would get in there, and I wonder why she scared me. I got to be careful. I'll just leave it be. She scared me in ways that still remain to this day. Let's put it like that. And if she's still around, God bless you. And if she's not, God rest her soul. But one of the things that we would do is she would give us each a little instrument or whatever. And three or four people would get this instrument, and she would teach us the armed forces songs, all the songs for the different military branches. And she used this album, you know, you drop the needle and you'd sing along with the album. And I never forgot that. I always thought it was really interesting. And who knew back in sixth and seventh grade at Belling Grammar School in Chicago with Mrs. DePago, when I was singing Semper Paratus is our guide, our fame and glory to fight, to save, or fight, to die, I, Coast Guard, we are. I had no idea that would ever be part of my life. But it did, and I'm proud of it. So sending you off with some military music, and my thanks again to all the veterans who have served. Be well, safe travels, adios.